Chapter 36 My Republican Friends. Okay, maybe 26% is a little high. Maybe it's more like 20% or 15, or maybe you're just a total pessimist and you think it's closer to 2%. But even if 98% of the time we're at an impasse, there's progress to be made in that 2%. Remember how my dad's quilting factory failed because the railroad wouldn't stop in Albert Lea to pick up his goods to bring to market? That's an example of something called captive shipping. In much of America, railroads enjoy a monopoly and are able to charge farmers and manufacturers exorbitant prices to carry their products. If you don't pay, the railroad doesn't stop, and you have to move to St. Louis Park to become a printing salesman. The Surface Transportation Board, STB, has jurisdiction over railroads. And just as George W. Bush invaded Iraq to avenge his own father, I wanted to make it easier for someone who had been the victim of captive shipping to do something about it. When I first got to the Senate, it cost $20,000 to lodge a complaint with the STB. If you're a small farmer watching freight trains zip through your community without stopping because you can't afford to pay the monopoly prices to the railroad, you tend not to have $20,000 lying around. I wanted to put pressure on the STB to lower the fee for lodging a complaint. But as is almost always the case, the odds of success were going to be far higher if I had a Republican partner, which is how I ended up working with David Vitter, an extremely conservative Republican with whom I almost never agreed and whose personal conduct I was repulsed by. Google it. Together, David and I got the STB to lower the fee to $350. And then we went back to voting against each other pretty much all the time. I've worked with John Bozeman from Arkansas on improving health care for veterans. I've worked with Deb Fisher from Nebraska on increasing access to rural broadband. I've worked with Bill Cassidy from Louisiana on addiction issues. I'm working right now with Tom Tillis from North Carolina on funding housing and wraparound services for people with mental illness. They're all extremely conservative Republicans who, I'm sure, don't want me to say anything good about them. And make no mistake, I hope they all get beat in their next elections. But they're there right now. And just as part of my job is standing my ground against all the terrible things they want to do, part of it is looking for opportunities to find common ground, because that's how stuff gets done. You see, there are only 100 of us senators, and none of us can do the job without working with the other 99. Mike Mansfield had a saying, "It only takes one senator to make a scene, but it takes more than one to make a difference." Okay, he never said that. I made it up. But if he had, it certainly would have made my point, which is that, sure, a lone senator can hold things up with a filibuster or some other procedural maneuver, but actually passing legislation takes teamwork. Very often, the only way a bill stands a chance is if you can find a co-sponsor in the other party to make it bipartisan. Sometimes you have a regional issue that requires you to cooperate with colleagues from neighboring states, even if you and said colleagues don't see eye to eye on pretty much anything else. For example, there's a history of flooding in the Red River Valley between Minnesota and North Dakota, so it's really important that North Dakota Republican John Hoeven and I be able to work together to fight for flood mitigation funding. That's why we have all these unwritten rules, like addressing each other as my esteemed colleague, even when we may, in fact, esteem each other very little. It's why you're not supposed to smirk or roll your eyes when someone else is giving a speech on the floor and you're presiding. That would be a real jerk move. It's why, as silly as it may sound, it's important that we try to like each other. That's right, like each other. Not just the Lamar Alexander types either. In my view, you've got to build friendships with the Jeff Sessions types too. Like, for example, with Jeff Sessions. When I first got to the Senate, Jeff was the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. and I made it a point to go to every hearing, no matter how perfunctory. Often we'd have a nomination hearing for a judge whose confirmation was completely non-controversial, and it would just be the chairman, Patrick Leahy, Jeff, and me. I wasn't just there because I had nothing else to do. I was there to prove that I had come to the Senate to work, not be a clown. And Jeff took notice. He saw me show up for every hearing. He heard me take the responsibility of questioning the nominees seriously. And even though he probably agreed with literally nothing I said, he quickly grew to like the cut of my jib. A few weeks in, Chairman Leahy had to miss a hearing, so he asked me to fill in. I arrived early, and when Jeff got there, he saw me sitting in the chairman's seat, holding the gavel. "Well," exclaimed Jeff in his thick southern drawl, "a meteoric rise." "And well deserved," I replied in my nasal Midwestern Jewish twang. Jeff laughed. He's been an easy laugh for me ever since, except at his confirmation hearing. Anyway, the point is, Jeff liked me, and here's why I like him. A few years later, the Judiciary Committee was holding a hearing on a Dianne Feinstein bill to protect American citizens apprehended within the United States on terrorism charges from being detained indefinitely without a trial. One of the witnesses was Stephen Bradbury, a lawyer who had written one of the Bush administration memos inventing some flimsy legal rationale for torture, thus contributing to the decline of our reputation on the world stage, inflaming anti-American sentiment in the Middle East, and putting our troops in more danger. I wasn't really interested in hearing this guy's thoughts on due process, and I told him so. "It's very difficult for me, frankly, to rely on your legal opinion today," I said, suggesting that someone with his record had no business testifying before the committee. It was pretty aggressive by Senate committee standards, so aggressive, in fact, that my questioning really offended some of the Republicans on the committee. But I didn't know that until Jeff was kind enough to call me and give me a heads up that I should probably cool it for a little while. It was a real act of friendship. I had had no idea that I was digging myself such a hole with my colleagues by teeing off on this ghoul, and I really appreciated that Jeff was gracious enough to clue me in so I could back off just a bit. When Trump won the election and nominated Jeff to be Attorney General, it was time for me to return the favor by setting aside my very real concerns about his record and the Trump administration's plans for the Department of Justice and just waving his nomination through. No, of course not. Being a senator does mean finding a way to make friends with people you're fighting against with every fiber of your being. But it also means finding a way to fight with every fiber of your being against people you're friends with. I rarely voted with Jeff when he was a senator, and that's fine. Senators disagree. But I knew that as Attorney General, he would represent a clear and present danger to the civil rights of millions of Americans. And his confirmation hearing would be my opportunity to raise that alarm, which I did without apology, calling him out for overstating his involvement in civil rights cases and holding his feet to the fire on Donald Trump's fear-mongering about voter fraud, which, of course, is nothing more than a pretext for voter suppression. And then I voted against him. Jeff Sessions is my friend, or was. Franny is friends with his wife, Mary. When our grandson Joe was born, Mary knit him a baby blue blanket, which became his favorite. It's hard to unfairly demonize someone whose wife knit your grandson his favorite blankie. Which is why when my job meant doing everything in my power to deny my friend this important position, I was relieved that there was so much to fairly demonize him for. For my part, I've tried to create more opportunities for us senators to be nice to each other. For example, at any given time, we have 30 or so pages working in the Senate. Pages are high school juniors, 16-year-old kids, who come to Washington to spend months helping out with day-to-day operations in the Senate chamber. They all live together in a dorm, and if I were a parent of one of them, I realized, I would want to know the senators were keeping an eye out for them and helping them to have a positive experience. So, Franny and I teamed up with Mike and Diana Enzi to start a tradition of throwing pizza parties and ice cream socials for these kids. Pages are generally not allowed to initiate conversations with senators, so Mike and I give them an opportunity to ask us questions like, is being a senator as much fun as being on Saturday Night Live? Or in Mike's case, is being a senator as much fun as being an accountant? Another initiative I spearheaded over the repeated and grumpy objections of Harry Reid was our annual Senate Secret Santa. I modeled it after the Secret Santa we had back in elementary school in St. Louis Park. The idea was that every kid would get a gift, but also that every kid would have to learn something about someone they maybe didn't know and do a nice thing for them. I figured it would be a fun, bipartisan thing for us to do, and because every senator who participated would get a present, no senator would get his or her feelings hurt. One year, though, Jeff Flake, an iconoclastic Republican from Arizona, kind of hurt my feelings by giving me a crappy present. A hat bearing the logo of Ping, which apparently is a golf equipment company based in his home state. I complained about it to Tim Kaine. Flake gave me this stupid hat. This is the worst Secret Santa gift ever. What was he thinking? Staff error, said Tim. He's really smart and would make a great vice president. God damn it. Now I'm depressed. Let's move on. Not surprisingly, the quickest way to my heart is through my funny bone, which isn't the elbow, but rather the rib that lies directly over the heart. Aw. And my favorite Republican colleagues aren't the ones whose politics are the least objectionable, but rather the ones with the best senses of humor, no matter how objectionable their politics may be. Pat Roberts has got to be near the top of that list. As I mentioned earlier, he loves Bob and Ray, but he loves Jack Benny even more, and he has a little bit of that famous Jack Benny comic timing. When I see him in an elevator or in the Senate subway, I usually greet him with a, "May I help you?" in the annoying voice of character actor Frank Nelson, a regular on the old Jack Benny program. Pat replies with a great Benny-esque, "You again." And then we laugh. No one within earshot has a clue what we're laughing about, and odds are neither do you, but we don't care. And though our politics couldn't be more different, we always jump at the chance to work on something together. For example, the regulations on drug compounding, which is when pharmacists mix prescriptions themselves from individual ingredients. Well, they were very confusing, and in 2012, 800 Americans contracted fungal meningitis, and 64 died due to unsafe drugs that shouldn't have been allowed to be distributed. Pat and I discovered that we both wanted to work on this issue, so we teamed up and closed the loopholes. Then there was a time I needed Republican votes for an amendment to get $11 million for energy projects in Indian country, so I asked Pat. He stood with me in the well of the Senate, doing his best to urge his Republican colleagues to help me. And by his best, I mean that Pat told them, "Leadership describes this as completely innocuous." I got the votes. Pat's funny, but the funniest Republican in the Senate is Lindsey Graham. Most of his jokes are of the "we're in a cynical business" variety. For example, before our Christmas break one year, Lindsey asked me if the Frankens were going anywhere for some sun. I told him we were going to Puerto Rico. Without missing a beat, Lindsey gave me some advice. Do two fundraisers, one with the folks for statehood, one with the folks against statehood. They never talk to each other. In 2016, Lindsey ran for president and found himself somewhere around 15 in a field of 17. Running into him in the senator's bathroom, I told him, "Lindsey, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you." Again, without hesitation, he replied, "That's my problem." Believe it or not, however, not every senator has a great sense of humor. Tom Coburn and I did not hit it off right away. A terrifyingly conservative Republican from Oklahoma, he was known as Dr. No for two reasons. First, Tom's an obstetrician-gynecologist. Second, he is an adamant federalist who believes the federal government has appropriated too much power from the states, which means he's pretty much opposed to Congress doing anything. But that's not why we didn't hit it off. Our first four or five interactions were just misses. Nothing terrible. Mainly, he just didn't seem to get where I was coming from. So I approached him at a Judiciary Committee hearing to take another shot at breaking the ice. Tom, can I buy you lunch? Tell you what, he said. Buy me breakfast. We sat down together a couple days later in the Senate dining room around 8 a.m. I had given some thought to how I wanted to start. Tom, I said cheerily, let's have fun. We can talk about anything, politics, our families, our careers, but let's make sure to have fun. Sure, he nodded. Fun. Okay, I said, careers. Let me ask you something. To be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education? Yes, he exploded angrily. You have to go to medical school. Ah, I had identified our problem. Okay, I explained. That was a joke. Tom understood immediately and calmed right down. You see, that's what I used to do for a living. I told jokes. I was in comedy. We did have fun for the next 45 minutes, and he wrote me a lovely note thanking me for breakfast and for the fun, which seemed like it had been a novel experience for him. Tom retired from the Senate after 2014 with a nearly perfect record of voting against everything I like. But when I called Tom a few months ago to make sure it was okay with him if I told this story, he agreed right away. You're a gentleman to ask, but there's a First Amendment. You can write anything you want. It was very Tom Coburn. Then we had some fun talking about grandchildren. I should note, I like my Democratic colleagues too, but I spend a lot more time with them and we agree on stuff, so it's easy to like them. It's harder to make friends across the aisle. And it's also more important. It's a lot easier to negotiate with people you trust and whom you don't personally dislike. And that's why you fight as hard as you can for your principles, but try not to be a jerk about it. It's why it's important that your word is good. It's why it's important to try to build these relationships with colleagues across the aisle, whether it's through family bonding or inside jokes or writing a country song together, which I did with Orrin Hatch. It's called We Stayed Together for the Kids, and I needed a bridge. When Orrin and I were working on it in his office, Orrin's scheduler called my scheduler and said, I don't know what's going on in there. They're just laughing. And the song kind of went like this. We stayed together for the kids. It was what we thought we had to do. But now the kids are up and gone. And there's just me and there's just you. That wasn't the bridge. Unfortunately, building those bonds is harder now than it used to be. For one thing, members of Congress used to bring their families to Washington to live. Members would see each other on weekends or just hang out. Their kids used to go to school together in D.C. or suburban Maryland or Virginia. It's hard to hate the parent of a kid who's on your kid's baseball team. To a great degree, the 1994 election changed that. Newt Gingrich told Republicans to run against Washington. They did, and they won. He told them to keep their families in their home districts, and they did. And for some of them, it put pressure on their family life. Newt, for example. But mostly, it meant that members would fly into D.C. on Monday afternoon and fly out on Thursday afternoon, a practice that has continued to this day. Meanwhile, our schedules have got more packed than ever. Every minute we don't spend fulfilling the requirements of our jobs, we're expected to spend raising money, and we're also expected to spend as much time as possible in our states, which doesn't leave a lot of time for getting to know and therefore trust your colleagues. At the end of the day, the Senate is like any other workplace. You don't always enjoy all of your coworkers, but you're far better off finding a way to get along with them than you are harping on the things you don't like. And being a successful senator is as much about being a good coworker as it is about being smart or well-versed in the issues or a talented orator. If you can be a pleasure to work with, you'll get more accomplished than if you're a pill whom no one can stand. Which brings me to Ted Cruz.